great. My guess is lots of people in the audience have questions. Do you have index cards from people who had questions that they wanted to ask? In the meantime, maybe you can tell us a little bit about your writing process. I understand you're somewhat of a night owl,
yeah.
and so a lot of your writing might take place 10, 11, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning.
It's terrible, but you know, I'm one of those people who only feels awake at 5 p.m. Like, I'm a sort of a zombie until 5 p.m., and then I'm just like, let's go, you know, and there's something really peaceful about writing after everyone else is pretty much in bed, at least the people in your time zone. There's no email pinging, there's no Twitter's kind of dead, it's all calmed down, and you feel like you're really alone with the material, and it's hard to feel alone with anything when you live in New York, so.
You mentioned email pinging, and you use an app called Freedom.
Oh, yeah.
That allows you, it's sort of like putting a lock on the refrigerator. You can't touch
it.
You can't get back into your, you can't log on.
Yeah.
And so you have this specified amount of time that you're not going to get bothered by your computer.
Yeah, it's actually a genius. If anybody ever needs to stop procrastinating online, I highly recommend downloading Freedom. I mean, it was either that or I was going to take a sledgehammer and just start, you know, nailing the interior mechanisms of the, you know, I don't know, even know what I was going to attack, but I was ready to attack something.
So do we have some questions? One of the things you do sometimes to get motivated to write, you play the Rocky theme song like a good Philadelphian might do.
Oh God, I forgot about all of my embarrassing habits. Yeah, I mean, there are days when you just don't feel like writing, and yet you have to do it anyway, like any other job. And in that case, I was, you know, the Rocky theme song is probably the cheesiest but most effective route to really just making yourself do something you don't want to do. At least I'm not eating raw eggs or getting my face pummeled yet. But it's about that level. So.
You mentioned that research is one of the most fun parts of writing. Why? And do you have stories about your research experiences?
Yeah, researching is, you know, I spend a lot of time in these musty old archives. And it's sort of just you alone with the history, which is really fascinating. And you, it's like a detective search. Every time you go to an archive, you're a detective looking for clues. You never know what's going to be in the next folder, in the next envelope. There's going to be connections you didn't know existed. A couple of my favorite ones. I went to the National Archives in Washington, D.C., where Rose O'Neill Greenhouse, she was another Southern spy living in the federal capital of Washington, D.C., all of her papers were seized. And I found her papers at the National Archives, including her cipher. She had memorized the cipher. She was given a cipher by a Confederate captain to memorize and to use when she encrypted dispatches to give them to her spies, her scouts. And she took this very seriously. If anybody's familiar with the Edgar Allan Poe short story, The Gold Bug, it looked like it was sort of akin to the cipher in that short story. She had symbols for all of the major
symbols
union.
Symbols for Lincoln.
And she had two nicknames for Lincoln, by the way. One was Beanpole, and the other was Satan. just to give you an idea of the level of animosity. And she was very serious about her spycraft. You know, if she didn't have time to encrypt a dispatch, she memorized the Morse code, and she would, at a certain appointed hour, one of her scouts would be looking at her window, and she would raise and lower her blinds according to the dots and dashes of the Morse code.
Or on the street, she would use her fan.
Yeah, it was quite ingenious. She would flutter her fan.
Really ingenious, because you said also that they worked out messages in their needlepoint.
Yeah. Yeah, Rose had what she called, her tapestry was a vocabulary of colors, and certain colors would signal certain letters, and she would weave them together and sort of either give them to one of her, she was allowed to have friends in and out of her house, even when she was under house arrest, and would give one of her friends this quilt to pass along to Confederate sources, or she would just drape it out the window.
Right under the noses
exactly.
of the enemy. Your books contain a high level of emotion. How do you extrapolate what they were feeling from the resources that you have? That's a great question.
It is a great question. And again, it goes back to doing the research. And, you know, fortunately, you know, three of the women wrote memoirs. Elizabeth Van Loo did keep a diary. And Belle Boyd, of course, was this big publicity whore who would give an interview to anyone. She was a terrible spy, but a great PR person for herself. and really just allowed you, they told you what they were thinking at the time or what they were feeling at the time, or how they acted and how they reacted. So it's those kinds of details that let you peek inside the head a little bit.
It must have been wonderful for you to hold a letter or a diary and know that Emma Thompson held this before you did, or Rose O'Neill Greenhow.
Yeah, I felt that way when I was looking through Elizabeth Van Loo's papers at the New York Public Library. Elizabeth, as I think I mentioned, was received death threats on a daily basis. Confederate operatives were following her. And one day she received a letter that said, it was written in red pencil, and I found this at the diary, or excuse me, at the library with her papers. It said, old maid, your house will be on fire. Please give us some of your blood to write with. And it was signed with the skull and crossbones. And I just sat there, you know, I got chills reading it. And I just couldn't imagine how Elizabeth would have felt receiving this, you know, back in 1864. And it's sort of, you know, you just smell the history. You know, you just, it's a visceral connection that you really need to bring the characters to life.
You know, and you talked about banging on the keyboard, waiting for these characters to talk to you. Is that how it sometimes felt?
It does. And I mean, I don't think that's unique to me. I think every novelist who are creating somebody, you know, their characters start talking to them. I don't create people, but I feel like I have to find them. You know, they exist, and I just have to find the details that flesh them out and make them come alive. And once I have that, then they do start talking to me. And I sound about as crazy as Belle Boyd right now, probably, so...
How did Emma maintain her disguise in the day-to-day life of a soldier?
That's a really good question, and one I was really fascinated with myself. You know, Patty, I think Patty had mentioned that there were an estimated 400 women who disguised themselves as men and enlisted either in the Union or Confederate armies. And I came to the conclusion that the main reason they got away with it was because nobody had any idea what a woman would look like wearing pants. You know, people were so used to seeing women's bodies pushed and pulled in these exaggerated shapes with corsets and crinolines that the very idea of a woman wearing pants, let alone an entire army uniform, was so unfathomable that they couldn't see it. And Emma, I think, had an advantage because she had been living as a man for 2 years by the time the war came around and had honed her mannerisms and her voice. But some of the women weren't as lucky, and they got caught. And a couple of my favorite stories about this. There was one Union soldier. Her general threw an apple to her, and she reached for the non-existent hem of her apron, and he realized what she was doing. She was reaching for a dress, so she was discovered that way. And then there was a corporal in New Jersey who gave birth while she was on picket duty. So it was kind of like, you know, the jig was up. You know, I gave birth. But some women were more subtle, I guess, than others.
You know, the crinolines that they wore, you wrote about some women being able to hide in there several pairs of boots, a bag of coffee, ammunition, meat. I mean, unbelievable what they could sneak across the lines.
Yeah, it was really remarkable. I mean, if you've ever looked at the old pictures of the crinoline, the Civil War era crinolines, they were these rigid cage-like structures that at their apex could reach a diameter of 6 feet. And they're, you know, made of these bones that are sort of coming up in like this ladder of ridges, and they could just tie anything there and did. I mean, these women had maybe 60 pounds of stuff tied to them at any given time and were sneaking across the lines and, you know, waving prettily at the Union sentries and who just were, you know, fine with letting them pass. It was just a pretty woman on her way home from the market, you know.
I think a lot of people are interested in what happened to these women later, and Emma Thompson did go on to marry, and she had children, although there was some tragedy. She lost some of her children. This person wants to know, little Rose was an interesting child. Do you know how she turned out as an adult?
There's a little bit about little Rose that I had found. She, of course, was inconsolable after her mother's tragic end. And ended up though graduating from school and flourishing and marrying a Union captain, from what I had discovered. So I don't
which
think
her mother must be rolling in her grave over
I
that.
I think she probably was. Yeah.
So what was your most aha moment in researching this book?
Aha moment. I think just realizing one of the most interesting things was realizing that the idea of female traitors was a new concept during the Civil War. You know, women's loyalty was assumed. Loyalty was supposed to be an attribute of femininity itself. You know, women were supposed to be victims of war, not perpetrators of war. And once, you know, Rose O'Neill Greenhouse activities started coming to light, and Belle Boyd to a lesser extent, the Union powers that be, you know, had to consider that women were not only capable of treasonous activity, but they were capable of executing it more deftly than men. And they didn't know what to do about this. You know, if they were too lenient, they risked letting these women run amok and cause more damage to the cause. And if they were too harsh, they risked elevating these women to the status of martyr and sort of a big PR disaster. And one of my favorite quotes in the book was a Lincoln official, and they were all having this big meeting about what to do, you know, with Rose O'Neill Greenhow. And this official said, you know, you could just hear the angst in his voice, "What are we going to do with these fashionable female spies?" And it was a question they really had to grapple with throughout the war.
One of the most amazing things I thought was Belle Boyd is in Europe. Her husband has been picked up and sent to jail, and she has the audacity to write almost a blackmail letter to President Lincoln saying, "If you don't release my husband, I'm going to release my book."
Yeah. Belle Boyd.
And a lot of Union officials are not going to look good.
Yeah, Belle had some balls. I will give her that. I think it helped that she was still a teenager. You know, this girl was 18 years old at the time, or 19, and threatening the President of the United States with absolutely no care in the world. And of course, Lincoln had other reasons, or maybe there was no connection at all. But her husband was released, so it worked.
And she released her book eventually as well.
She did. I think she calmed it down. Yeah, I think she calmed it down a little bit.
So what do you feel are the most important lessons we can take from the brave women in your book for women living in today's divided and racially charged political environment?
Oh, wow. Well, I guess the first thing is to, talking about relating to these characters. When I was writing about the Southern women, especially Rose O'Neill Greenhow, it was difficult. She had abhorrent views on race. She had said some very offensive things, and I had to find a way to write about her without making her a stock villain. You know, I didn't personally like her politics, but I had to put her in the context of the time and what her background was and what her deal was. To apply it to today, I mean, I just think the themes of the Civil War are something that are perennial themes in this country, especially today with the subject of police brutality and Black Lives Matter. And race should always be a discussion that we're having, I think.
Part of Rose's deal, by the way, you write, is that her father was killed by one of her slaves, murdered by one of her slaves.
Yeah, and she was only 4 years old at the time, and I'm sure that imprinted on her psyche. But also, you know, when the war broke out, in the years leading up to the war, Rose's whole life had fallen apart. She had lost 5 children in 4 years, if you can imagine that. She had lost her husband in a freak accident, and she had lost her access to the White House. Rose had been a very powerful woman who had ties and had been friends with high-ranking Democratic politicians. She was even a very close advisor to former President James Buchanan. And she lost all of that when Lincoln and the Republicans came to power. So I think the death of her children, the death of her husband, and the loss of her entire social network put her in a place of deep desperation and depression. I think she was severely depressed. And that was one of the reasons she was pretty much willing to die and not only risk her own life, but that of her daughter.
You mentioned some of this, but there might be something to add to it. What reliable sources of information did you consult in researching for your books?
Oh, I just had a lot of fun researching for this. I mentioned Elizabeth's papers, Rose's papers. I'll tell you another story about Rose's papers that was really fascinating. There's a pivotal scene in the book. It's early on. It is the first major land battle of the war. It's the Battle of Manassas in Virginia in July of 1861. And Rose was also quite a seductress. She seduced several Union politicians, including the Senator Henry Wilson from Massachusetts, who was not only an abolitionist Republican, but he was Lincoln's chairman of the Committee on Military Affairs. And I had a great time reading the rather torrid love letters
that he sent to her.
Right preceding the Battle of Bull Run, had wrapped up a dispatch in this piece of black silk. And I found this scrap of black silk just sitting in a folder. It wasn't protected by any paper. It wasn't in a bag. It was just labeled, you know, Rose O'Neill Greenhouse Silk. And, you know, I picked this up in my hand, and I was sure I was going to get kicked out of the National Archives. You know, the guards were around, and I was just like, oh, you know. But it's, again, it's those moments that really give you a connection to your characters and sort of make you viscerally involved.
One of the things you didn't get to handle, and sounds like such a loss to me, is that Mary Jane Bowser actually had kept a diary, and a descendant of hers accidentally apparently threw it out.
Yeah, it's you know, to sort of bring Mary Jane Bowser back into context, I often get asked, why isn't it five women undercover in the Civil War? Because Mary Jane Bowser, the former family slave who was a spy in the Confederate White House, was an integral part of Elizabeth's Union operation, and I don't think the North would have won without Mary Jane either. But the problem was that I did not have the primary source material from Mary Jane to put scenes from her point of view, to write scenes from her point of view. So I had to filter all of her experience through Elizabeth. And, you know, I found out during the course of my research that the lore is that she did keep a diary of her time in the Confederate White House, and that her couple descendants of hers, not realizing what they had in their hands, the treasure, accidentally threw it out, which just made me, you know, would make any historian, you know, it's a pain.
And I can't even imagine.
Pain, yeah.
Imagine how dangerous it was for her to be keeping a diary and living in the Confederate White House. It's just almost unfathomable.
She did, after the war, write a few letters where she alluded to her service to the Union. So I felt confident that, you know, she was there. She's recognized by the U.S. government as having been there. But unfortunately, if she ever told of her experiences, we're never going to read them.
This is sort of follow-up to what you were just talking about, but did you research other women of the Civil War, and how many, and why did you pick four? You've sort of alluded to some of that, or tell us about other women that couldn't have made it into the book.
Well, I'll tell you about one of my favorite spies. It was actually a man that I did put in the book in a little just slipped him in a periphery mention. I couldn't resist. His name was Benjamin Franklin Stringfellow. He was a Confederate spy for General Jeb Stuart, and he was blonde-haired, blue-eyed. He weighed 94 pounds, and according to some of his comrades, he had a waist as wispy as a woman's, and he had a rather unorthodox approach to his spying. He would find out when and where the Union was holding military balls, and he would dress up in his most elaborate ball gown, and he would go to the ball and introduce himself as Sally Martin. And Sally Martin was the prettiest girl at the dance. Everybody wanted to dance with Sally Martin. So he would wait to be asked, and then he would pump his dance partners for information about what Ulysses Grant was up to, what the Union was planning, and he would report all of that back to General Jeb Stuart. And I just wanted to include him just to show that, you know, the women weren't the only ones cross-dressing during the war. You know, the men were in on that too, so.
Your book references passing messages and information in hair, and of course you also talked about the crinoline, the hoop skirts. Was information passed in quilts?
Oh, well,
and I guess that would be the needlework.
That would be the needlework. Yeah. They had a lot of really interesting methods of passing information. I'll give you another story. I hope nobody's just eaten dinner, but I went to the Museum of the Confederacy in Richmond, Virginia, and the curator told me a story, and I'll just tell you the story as she told it to me. A woman came in a couple years earlier with this little object. It was just this gold little heart-shaped, it looks like an acorn. And she said that her Confederate ancestor had been a spy, and that he reportedly had tiny little scrolls dispatched, he rolled up into a scroll, put it in this little contraption, and then hid the contraption in the place least likely to be searched. So the curator called this the anal acorn. I usually show a picture of it, and I really should.
It looks big
it
in
looks
the picture.
Big. I should really show it to scale and have a ruler, because the thing looks about this big, and it was not that big. I don't know how many Confederate soldiers were subjected to the anal acorn, but I knew that I never read about it in history books, and I wanted to put it in mine. So
they also hollowed out fruit and vegetables and stuck notes in those.
Yeah.
How often were people caught for these sorts of things?
Well, it was, they were pretty ingenious, especially in Elizabeth's operation. They would use hollowed out eggs, fruit. They would, and she had servants who would hollow out the heels of their boots and stuff things into those. And she actually, you know, shoes were incredibly expensive in the South during the war. She bought everybody a new pair of shoes pretty much every week or even more often because they got so worn out from walking. But again, she was using a lot of former slaves, and they were below suspicion. And they just sort of acted as if they were doing chores and for their families and their masters, and nobody bothered them.
Here's a process question. How do you overcome writer's block?
Sometimes I just do not overcome it, and I just let it go. Other times, you know, you really have to just tell yourself, if anybody's not read Bird by Bird, Anne Lamott, it's a really probably the best book you could ever read for getting over writer's block. The story is that she had to write an essay as a young kid, or maybe it was her brother who had to write an essay, and about birds. And the father, her father, just said, you know, take it bird by bird, buddy. Just take it bird by bird. And it's just sort of write a paragraph, then write the next paragraph, then just get through that scene. And don't be afraid of what she calls shitty first drafts. Your first draft is going to be bad. It's supposed to be bad. It's a first draft. So just let it. And nobody's reading it but you. So it's safe. And you just have to keep reminding yourself that you're not expected. The muse is, you know, don't just sing down into your ears and the words flow effortlessly from your fingers to the screen. There's a process, and you have to just let yourself go through the process. So,
interestingly, you loved writing when you were a kid, but never thought of it as a career. And in fact, initially, you thought you'd become a lawyer.
Yeah, I was a kid, and I loved to write. When I was 12 or 13, I would write these terrible stories about murderous, they were all cross-dressing women, too. These murderous, matronly, grandmothery, cross-dressing women who went out and killed people.
This is in Catholic school in Philadelphia. You worried your teachers.
I was going to say, you know, I ended up writing about strippers and prostitutes. I'm clearly putting my 16 years of Catholic schooling to good use. But I would write these stories and submit them to Ellery Queen, Mystery Magazine, and Alfred Hitchcock. And of course, they all came back and were like, no, thank you. But it's true. I did think that writing was something that people grew up and actually did for a living. Then I realized when I was in college that I was, number one, sick of school. Number two, too poor for any more school. I already had student loans piling up. Happened to get an internship at Philadelphia Magazine. And I don't know if anybody's been around groups of journalists, but they are the craziest. I think they're even crazier than novelists. They are crazy people, and I loved all of them. And you know, the fun thing about journalism was you get to go out there and inhabit somebody else's life for a period of time and then write about it.
And you've interviewed some really interesting people. For American Rose, for example, you interviewed her sister practically on her deathbed, Gypsy Lee's Rose sister.
Yeah, that was an interesting. I don't know if anybody's familiar with the theater actress June Havoc. She was Gypsy Rose Lee's sister. She was a vaudeville prodigy. And when I met her, I was the last journalist to ever interview her. I met her, she was about 96 at the time. And, you know, I went up to her farm in Connecticut. She's in bed. She's bedridden, which I can't even imagine for somebody who was spent their life dancing. She had little silver pigtails. Her hair is done up in little tiny pigtails. She is dipping Oreos in milk. And, you know, anytime I asked a question, she would sweetly answer it and then say, "What else?" And, you know, you just got the sense that she was totally bedridden, immobile. But if you offended her in any way, she could leap up and strangle you. You know, she was one of those really sort of big presence people. And I just thought, oh, my God, if I had her, Gypsy Rose Lee, and their crazy mother, who was literally a homicidal maniac, she was a murderer. It was the dynamic of the three of them was just incredible and incredibly disturbing at times. And fun. The incredibly disturbing stuff is always fun.
And we've sort of touched on this before, but I'll ask this one as well. What parallels do you see between pre-war sentiments and the emotions at play around the country today?
I mean, yeah, I think that, you know, one of the things that really struck me is I think I said in the beginning that the Civil War never ended for the South. It's still going on. I think that, you know, after Reconstruction, it was even the sentiment started. Then, of course, when Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act in the 60s, he said, the Democrats have lost the South for a generation. And we're still seeing the effects of that. And look at our presidential election and look at the way our African American president has been sort of, I think, treated with a level of disrespect that's not, hasn't been leveled at any other president, I think it's fair to say.
Two final questions. You talked really about how you were even-handed in describing someone like Rose O'Neill Greenhow, and so I'm wondering, what was the reaction to your book? Was it different in the South than it was in the North?
I actually, people in the South thanked me, some women, for not making Rose a villain or a caricature.
And there's a monument to her now, right?
There's a stone, yeah, for her service to the Confederacy in North Carolina. But she, I think that, and I was accused, too, by people in the North of not, painting the Southern women in a more negative light. And to me, I'm not writing a dissertation. I'm not arguing a point. I'm telling a story, and I'm telling history, and I think the point of my role as a narrative historian is to put the characters out there, warts and all. Let people make their own judgments. Paint them as real people and let people sort of take away what they will. It's not my job to condemn the South. I think it's probably, clear that nobody, today, I'm not a proponent of slavery, but it wasn't my job to really whitewash any of it, so to speak.
To pass judgment
on
it. So I think it might be fun to end this session with a somewhat hidden talent of yours,
okay.
And that is this ability in 10 seconds to recite all of the U.S. presidents. And for fun today, could you end this with who you think will be our next president?
Yikes. God, usually I do that trick after several drinks, but I will attempt it sober. Okay. All right. I will. Let me get on this. Okay. Tell me when to start.
5, 4, 3, 2.
Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, Adams, Jackson, Buren, Harrison, Tyler, Port, Kilo, Former, Pierce, Buchanan, Lincoln, Johnson, Gray, and Hayes, Carr, Father, Cleveland, Harrison, Cleveland, McKinley, Roosevelt, Taft, Wilson, Harding, Coolidge, Hoover, Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, 64, Carter, Reagan, Bush, Clinton, Obama, Clinton.
Very good. All right. Well, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you all for coming. Thank you.
Yeah, and maybe you can just tell people real quickly. The name on the book is Karen Abbott, but you have officially changed your name to Abbott, your first name to Abbott.
Yeah, my name is Abbott Kaler. Kaler is my married name. Short story, long story, I'll tell it quickly. A reader wrote to me a few years ago and said, do you know that if you Googled yourself, it says you died in 2010? And I was like, this is why I never Google myself. I thought I was still all right. I thought, I didn't know I was Weekend at Bernie-ing for the last. But sure enough, I Googled myself and it says, my picture came up and it says died 2010. And it was really super creepy. And a couple of my book covers were beneath this, but they were mixed in with other book covers, books I didn't write. One, they were romance novels, you could tell. One was called Farrington's Fortune, and then there was Take Hold of Tomorrow and other titles like that. And I thought, clearly there's a romance writer named Karen Abbott who quite possibly died in 2010, I don't know. I was nearing 40 at the time, and I was having, of course, my requisite 40-year midlife crisis. And I thought, I'm just going to change my name. So my legal name is Abbott Kaler. For nonfiction, I have to keep a Karen Abbott for just because it's been my name for 10 years. But if I ever write a novel, it will be Abbott Kaler. So hopefully people will still find me. Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, and thanks for coming.